This is the Creative Sports Podcast. My name is Justin Peterson.
And joining me are Brock Rahm.
Whatever you just touched, it like adjusted your microphone.
And Garrett Wright.
All right. Get everything else closed out. All right. Well, you guys ready to jump in?
Traditional sports hours, social media, requests of your time and needs, working with different personalities, and of course, the current situation of the pandemic can lead to a point where we need to take a step back and evaluate our well-being. John Willie is joining us this week to talk about his focus with mental wellness.
So, John, we sync by going to time.is, and then we pick a second to clap on. All right. To sync and nice. Post.
Unnecessary, but why the hell
unnecessary,
not?
Unnecessary, but it...
Hey, why not?
Let's do 30 here.
This feels so legit.
It's the real deal. That's how you know we're a real podcast. We clap.
I know, right?
Hey, everyone. Welcome to the show. My name is Garrett Wright. I want to start out with a big thank you to APM Music for donating the tracks we use on this podcast. Also, a reminder that this podcast is an extension of the sports creative community on Slack. So if you're hearing this and not a member of that community yet, you should head over to sportscreativeslack.com and sign up for free. Let's do it. All right. Today we are joined by John Wilhey, who co-founded the mental health focused media company Better and serves there as the VP of content strategy and creative. He comes from a sports background, having previous stops with the Arizona Diamondbacks and Miami Dolphins in various roles, managing and directing creative photo and video. So we are excited to have you. Thanks for joining us today, John.
It's great to be here, guys. Thanks for having me.
Can you, just tell us a little bit about Better, about what that is and what the focus is there?
So Better started about 2 years ago from my co-founder Tom Eriks, who was one of the early Facebook employees, he retired in 2014 and wanted to, invest in some purpose-driven companies. There was a company called Blueprint at the time that he invested in. I was in a position to move on to my next thing from the Dolphins. And Chris Liskowitz, who may be a friend of the group, he was one of the creative directors for Alabama and was with the Florida Panthers for a while and had some great runs, was there as VP of creative. And I reached out to him and he said, yeah, let's do this. And so I got to know Tom really well and then made the jump into entrepreneurship, which was something that I've been wanting to do for a long time. My favorite podcast is How I Built This with Guy Raz, and I just consume it like crazy. I've always had a little bit of an entrepreneurial itch inside me, well, a lot of one. And so this was my chance to do this. It was also a chance to bring my family back out to the Midwest, where they had known, dry heat and wet heat for our whole lives there. But my wife and I grew up in the Midwest, so getting the four seasons was going to be real important for us. And then we quickly shifted away from Blueprint, which was highly focused on student athlete wellness, to address the greater market, which was Gen Z and millennial mental wellness, we like to call it, versus necessarily mental health, because there's so many aspects to mental health that, it has a negative tonality to it quite a bit. We'll still say mental health a lot because it's kind of what people know. But really, mental wellness is, how do we provide optimism? How do we provide joy? How do we provide hope? And to a generation that needs it. We couldn't have predicted a pandemic happening and everybody being in school, at their own houses, or having to go back and live with their parents at 25 years old, potentially even with a family. It's been quite a ride. It's not easy setting up a media company anytime, right? It's especially not easy setting up a media company in the middle of a pandemic. And we've had to pivot multiple times in multiple locations. But ultimately, the goal is to provide provide tangible wellness strategies for young people to deal with. And you can see that on our Instagram page, and you can see what we've been building on the content side, and we're still continuing to figure out, like test the market, see how it works, see what people really need, because it's less about what I think people need, and it's more about amplifying the voices of those young kids and young adults who are really truly making a difference. And you could tell, you know, with the with TikTok blowing up where it has been, and Instagram still continuing to dominate, you know, if you follow one psychologist or psychotherapist who's made an impact on TikTok, you're going to get all the other one. It's a great place to be. It's a really positive, really empowering and open place to really break the stigmas. So that's what we are attempting to do and attempting to amplify.
For you personally, why is mental health so important, and why is that something that you're as passionate about as you are?
Yeah. So, I never understood mental health, really probably until I was about 40 years old, which was about 3 years ago. I had been in sports my entire life. My undergraduate work and graduate work was in sports medicine, and I was an athletic trainer, for a long time. and that was a blast. But as you guys know, having worked in the business, it was kind of a crazy hours, you know. When I was working in minor league hockey in Phoenix, it was, you know, sometimes 100-hour weeks, with travel included, you know, on a bus driving up to Northern California and Canada and everywhere. So that was, it got to a point where we realized that if we were going to have a family, which we wanted to do, that it wasn't probably sustainable. And I think you can hear that from a lot of athletic trainers who have been in the business for a long time. So I was always a creative, I'd been an artist my whole life since the beginning of what I can remember. Really got into photography when my dad was in the Gulf War, and we had a photographer for U.S. News and World Report come and stay with us and do a report on our family for a week, and I just got to shoot with all her stuff, and it was fascinating to me on how I could create. But I've never liked to stick to one thing, and I just happened to come across. I was working, for the Phoenix Roadrunners, and we were owned by the Colangelo Group at that time, who owned the Suns and the D-backs. And I saw an email come across for a photo archivist job with the D-backs, and I said, who wouldn't want to do this? You know, like, this is something that I can go in and really kind of explore. And I was doing a lot of photography because I had access. And so I was the photographer for, like, the Ohio Athletic Trainers Association when I was at Bowling Green, had a chance to really build my portfolio, shooting as many things as I could. I was watching everything Scott Kelby was putting out at the time and just trying to learn on my own. And that was the beginning of all that stuff, right? Like, this was the beginning. YouTube didn't hardly even exist at that point. And so you were buying DVDs from all these guys, and it was a crazy, crazy different world back then. But
Layers magazine too.
Oh my gosh, that was the best. And so I applied for it, and I told my wife, and she's like, ha-ha, good luck, basically. And the next thing I know, I got it. And I took a pay cut, and I said, let's do this. I want to make this happen. And I had set some pretty early goals. I met a lot of amazing people, and they really do say that relationships drive, you know, your career half the time, if not more. And that was what happened to me. I had gone through some, you know, some tough times, as we all have in sports. There were times when I was, you know, overseeing portions of the video creative department, overseeing the creative department at the D-backs, also overseeing photography. And that's just, like, in the middle of 2011, you know, doing a big playoff run. We hosted an all-star game that you planned for 2 years in advance. I noticed some things with my anxiety. I was always a people pleaser. And so it was always like, I never wanted to have the tough conversation. For me, that sucked. And I never wanted to, you know, have people be mad at me or disappointed in me. And that's a hard thing to do when you're trying to be in a leadership position. It's really, really hard. Fast forward to, gosh, probably 2017, 2018. My mental health kind of took an all-time low. I was at the Dolphins. There was this feeling, and we talk about it a lot on some of my podcasts and other podcasts, that when you're in sports, you're looked up to very much. And everybody wants your job, and everybody wants to do what you're doing. And because of that, you allow a lot of people into your inner circle. And that was, to me, that was how I was building my program, our program with Surf and Patrick and Ariel and that crew, and Will at the Dolphins. but what that did was it took a big toll on my mental health, because I was at the point where, you know, I wanted to do everything for everybody. And I just realized that I couldn't. And it started, it ramped up to a point where I just couldn't really function. I mean, it was even a point where the tipping point for me was one morning when I was trying to work on a pretty basic photo book of the renovation and trying to put a creative brief together so that Jeff could knock it out. I just couldn't do it. I couldn't do it because I felt overwhelmed with everything that I had to do that day, that time, in the midst of a football season. These are things that I could normally do in my sleep. And I was in such a fog, because of everything and everybody that I was trying to please at the time, that it really affected my anxiety. I was waking up at 3 a.m. consistently for months on end in full sweats. Don't get me wrong, like, you were quote unquote living the dream. Like, I was quote unquote living the dream, right? Traveling everywhere, eating like king, private planes. Now, it was hard work, but it was also, you kind of forget who you are and you live in these two lives. And so I was on the phone with one of my friends who's back in Phoenix, and he was like, "Listen, dude, you are not yourself. And if you don't get an appointment to go see a therapist tomorrow, I'm flying out there." And I knew he would do it too, but I knew he didn't need to do it. So I got an appointment with a therapist, really quickly. And that kind of changed who I was. I was able to go in and really kind of understand what was bothering me, understand like how I was pleasing everyone instead of the people that I needed to be taken care of, which was myself and my family. And I had really given everything that I had, probably selfishly and somewhat ego-driven, to be in the space that I was. I had to really take a quick step back over time, because I learned about cognitive dissonance. I learned about compassion fatigue. I learned about all these things that were affecting me that I didn't know about. I learned about other people's mental health problems and how they affected me. So that was the kind of pivot point. Really quickly after that was when I was able to come to Blueprint and Better and, kind of get out of the environment. Again, I always say that I'm never bashing the place that I worked. There were people in places that got me to where I was, as a career wise, and I would have never been in this situation otherwise. But it was really important for me to kind of break away from some of it, and start fresh. And so that led me into this point where I was starting to have deeper conversations with folks like my mom, you know, who had dealt with panic and anxiety her whole life, and I never knew, you know, and it was breaking the stigmas of being on medication to help control it, and what are the things that I can do, breathing techniques and square breathing that I could help. And so my goal was to, with the team that we have, you know, transform, like, apply these techniques and principles for people that, like me, unlike me, that are dealing with it. So really everyone. And that's really what got me into it. And that's really where the passion is for me. Now, on the outside, kind of looking back in at where I was, I still deal with those things today, you know, to this day, but I'm able to control how I process that. I can kind of step outside of myself on certain things and say, I am not in immediate danger. You know, day one, the first thing my therapist taught me was square breathing and understand that fight or flight is saying your heart's racing and that you're in immediate danger, but you're not. Your life's not in immediate danger. You're just maybe having a hard conversation about things, you know? And so it's helped me to this day. I still think about those things to this day, every day. But now it's how can I build a company that's going to really make change?
We generally see, I think it can be hard to have open discussions about mental health, especially in the sports industry, because it can be self-perceived almost as a sign of weakness when it's not. I think it's getting better on the student athlete side. I say student athlete because I used to work at Notre Dame and I'm used to working with college students, but not just the student athlete, but the athlete side. What needs to happen further to break down that stigma, not just on the athlete side, but on, like you said, the support staff side and everybody who has to work those crazy hours? What needs to happen to open up this conversation more?
So we talk about it a lot, right? We talk about it on the sports creative platforms. We've talked about it. I've talked about it with Bryce and Dan yesterday on the iPodcast. We've talked about it on my podcast a lot. There's some toxicity on Twitter and design Twitter that we all know about. And then there's some really, really good work being done. And what we have to do is focus on the good work that's being done, but we can't just talk about it anymore. Like we have to, I tweeted the other day that we have to talk about mental health and act on mental health and mental health benefits the same way we do with vision benefits, the same way we do with dental benefits, and the same way we do with health benefits. It's been far too long that mental health has been looked on, to your point, Brock, as this thing that nobody talks about because it is showing a sign of weakness. I was told multiple times, like, it's just in your head, man. Like, you can overcome it. That person clearly has not gone through something like that or is covering for it. And so we have to break down. I think the discussions are becoming so much more prevalent right now in dealing with it. And you know what? To an extent, they need to be selfish discussions because self-care is super important, because otherwise you're just going to see massive turnover in this, you know. And it's there are some, like, listen, we could talk forever, right, about pay disparity and the hours worked in sports, but ultimately everybody signs up for the job that they want. They have a choice to take the job that they're going into, but they also have a choice to try and elicit change. You know, there have been discussions on, like, creative unions, things like that. Like, how does everybody rise up together to make a difference? But ultimately, we need to be talking to the people in HR, the people in, they don't even tend to call them HR, you know, departments anymore. It's people departments. And if you're in a league, talking to those in the league, and they have to, in sports, you know, they're doing work. You guys can probably speak to this more than I can now, but they're doing work for the athletes. They're providing programs and outlets for the athletes. Are they doing the exact same thing for their employees? If you go and ask for mental health leave, are you given it first and foremost? You know, I've heard stories about people who haven't been given it. I've heard stories about people who have been given it. And there needs to be some real solid work done to normalize that mental health is not just something that people are faking. And I think that's one of the biggest things that we have to get over, is how do we normalize that taking a mental health day is just the same as taking a sick day if you had the cold. That's it. And then providing some tangible options, right? We have all these, all these wellness fairs, right? Health fairs at your work. And you guys probably have had some of those. I know we had those at every place that I worked at. How do we do more than just offer a once a year massage you know, chair massage for 5 minutes that you're in line with everybody else, you know, or getting the swag from the dentist. And like, health fairs need to change, in my opinion. And we need to be offering more options to therapy, more options in talking about things like BetterHelp, you know, or Headspace, providing Calm or Headspace accounts to everyone on your team. You know, it's how much do we invest in? We invest a ton in your physical health, but are we investing enough as companies in your mental health? And so it's, you just have to start having those conversations because the stigmas need a break. And there are a lot of people, you know, a lot of brands who are still, or teams who are still good old boys clubs. Like, it sucks to say, but they really are. And those are some things that we have to, to change the stigmas. Like, listen, we're dealing with it in our government right now, right? And how do we make progressive change and systemic change? And where do we start to do that? I think those are the conversations that people need to be having. And to me, it's continuing to spur on that conversation, because you know what? It's not one person's idea that's going to make it happen. It's everybody's ideas together that are really going to make it happen. And so that's where I think, you know, that's where I think things are going. And I think people really need to put a big, big time focus on.
It was interesting that you mentioned social media and the toxicity of that, because I think, you know, hearing the last handful of years about FOMO and how that has really been on the rise. So it's interesting that you're taking to social media to also share a positive message. So what performs well on your end, on your channels, on social media?
Yeah. It's funny. You guys probably get this in being in the production world. We got this at the Dolphins a lot. Our best performing content was usually something shot on a cell phone that happened very quickly and was just, it caused an emotional connection, right? Kenny Stills giving a jersey to a young kid after a game who's suffering with cancer, like that. And it just happened to be that Vince was there and shot it with his cell phone. Jarvis Landry doing the same thing, signing a kid's jersey, making his day. Those were things that performed well for us. With Better, those are the things that perform really well for us. We can spend thousands of dollars creating amazing content, and to us, like, the team's amazing content and pushing it out on YouTube to 300 views, where we, you know, we write a handwritten note on a post-it note and take a picture of it on our mirror in our bathroom, and it gets 250,000 views, you know, in the best engagement that we have. Those sort of things are quick tools that give people something to break away. And that goes way back to the concept of fight or flight, right? And your frontal lobe. We're getting a little technical here in that, but that's, you have to kind of break that transition. When we do stim, you know, on your arm because your your forearm hurts, what we're doing is we're providing an electrical current in there to override the pain sensations. And so we have to come up with these things that override the worry and the fight or flight sensations in your frontal lobe. And so it's those little things. It doesn't need to be much. It needs to be something that someone can connect to, right? We do these things called Better Breaks where we take people through a quick 30-second breathing exercise with great music and some really cool drone footage that people can just kind of stop thumbing through their Instagram feed and take a breathing break. Those are the things that work for us really, really well. And then you just have to get real with storytelling. You know, you have to there's things on TikTok that we've done with you know, breaking out of the norm. Like, what are things that we can do in the garden to help us feel better? How are there yoga poses that you can do when you wake up in the morning? That's the stuff that blew up for us. And so you have to look at those signals and say, okay, this is what people really need. And then they need tangible things. Like, you know, I always have these, it seems weird, but I always have these little fidgets at my desk, and I don't know if we're doing video for this, but this is called an infinity cube, and I literally could just sit here with it the whole time. And it's allowing my hands to be occupied, while we're talking about something. And I, you know, this is a non-stressful, thing for me right now, but if I was in a stressful, hard conversation, these are things that help control a little bit of that, of that stress and those dopamine rushes. So yeah, that's the stuff that's been working really well for us.
You mentioned TikTok there. I mean, like, what do you think? Why is TikTok such a great platform for this? You know, is it the audience you're reaching? Is it the nature of it? You know, what is it about TikTok that works so well for this type of media?
Yeah, there's a couple different ways. So TikTok and Instagram are not conversion platforms when you look at them. They're literally connection platforms. And so connection and community, and the term community is looked on multiple different ways. I had a really good talk with Kai Elmer, who was one of the early Facebook directors of community, who's in charge of building community when Facebook was kind of at a pivotal point. Wrote a great book called Get Together, which I can't recommend enough, with one of the early Instagram employees as well. And they, you know, for them, they don't even like to use the word community, to be honest with you, because you're building your it's hard to say, right? You're almost building your family. You're building this network of people who are trying to do something good for humanity together. because community has been given this interesting stigma by a lot of different people these days. So for us, it was a quick way to leverage people that were making a difference, right? I just think, like, there's multiple reasons why it works, right? And there's enough people who will tell you that it's super toxic as well, when they're on there in the comment sections. But any comment section is going to be filled with trolls, especially if you're successful, because it's insecurities from other people who are jealous of your success. That being said, it's been really powerful for us because of multiple things, right? Because of their algorithm, because of their discovery method, you can find anybody that you want, and you can get served any content that you want. And then, you know, my buddy Will sends me different TikToks all the time, and you kind of do this cleanse your feed thing, and you're like, oh crap, I got caught in political TikTok. I need to get out of political TikTok and into whatever TikTok, you know. And it's been a great way for us to test the market, test things that can work. It doesn't work the same way, you know, as any other. You can't just put your YouTube video on TikTok and think it's going to work. It's not. We tried. It didn't work. So there's multiple ways of doing it, but I think it's just so, to use an overused term, it's very authentic. But then they've tapped into everything, right? The trends and just the way that you can do things, certain things on Twitter. Tell me you're this without telling me you're this, right? That's the hot thing right now. And it's absolutely blown up with the stitching factor on TikTok. So the network effects really kick in when you're on there, even more so than Twitter.
When you talk about your strategy and experimenting and trying new things, how do you approach that from the content creation side when you're trying new things, so that it feels like it's coming from better as your organization and what types of content you're showcasing online?
I guess that's the $1 million question, right? And it's something where you have to move fast. One of the things that you could talk to anybody on our team and they'll tell you quickly that, like, if we try something, we attempt to try something very quickly, and see if it has any legs and see what signals we get really quick. We're focusing a little more in the podcast space as well too lately. And you can really get some quick signals, from the podcast space. But on the flip side, it takes a lot of patience and it takes a lot of money to grow, those sort of things. So I worry a little bit about the algorithms. I worry a little bit about the advertising and how that's going to be changing with, you know, ad blockers in iOS 14 and those sort of things, and the fight going on between Facebook and Apple right now. All of those things you really have to think about when it comes into play. But really, you need to be throwing out content and just seeing what it works, seeing, you know, if it's paid versus organic, what's really resonating with your, like, it's marketing Twitter, right? Like, so you've got this marketing Twitter that if you look at it, it's usually a bunch of dudes saying pretty obvious stuff. They're just saying it loudly for people to hear. Whereas a lot of companies in the back end are working a lot on all those things to try and make it work. It really comes down to, if you break it down, it's trying multiple things, and you have to look at the signals and you have to pivot quickly if something's not working. It's pretty simple, right? When you break it down. But then, you know, you can pay a lot of money for content, or you can pay a lot of money for an influencer. And so there's all these things that you have to decide and what's going to affect your brand more. You know, Ian from SeatGeek will tell you that the 3 years that he went after David Dobrik were paid off, you know, but it paid off 3 years later, because he was able to, you know, to land David and they were able to do some, the brand awareness for them was tremendous, just because of that. So yeah, it's an interesting thing to play. Like, you look at someone like Teenager Therapy, who we've partnered with, five kids from San Diego who, you know, honestly, like, they reached out to us a couple years ago and we're like, hey, we're starting this podcast. We'd love to work with you guys. And we're just kind of like, cool, that's fun, you know. And a year later, they're coming back and we're pitching them to come work with us, you know, because they're getting 3.5 million views over a 5 month stretch. So you just never really truly know what's going to hit, you know, because then you could have this insanely highly produced podcast go absolutely nowhere. You know, I listen to Startup quite a bit from Gimlet, and I've followed the Gimlet story for a long time and how they built this. And they were able to ride the coattails a little bit of Serial in This American Life, which was amazing for them. But then, you know, they just had a lot of really good, they had a lot of things that worked and they had a lot of things that didn't work. You kind of have to ride the things that work and continue to go with them and figure out what really forecast what the next thing is. It's really, really hard to do. Let's put it that way.
I mean, what's that been like for you? You mentioned earlier kind of at the beginning of starting this company in a pandemic. I mean, what have the challenge has been beyond just that trial and error figuring out like what your content is? I mean, what has it been like trying to deal with, you know, everything that 2020 has thrown at you as a kind of first time entrepreneur?
I think the hardest part has been, without a doubt, how do you monetize in order to get cash infusion in your company. We've been lucky with where we've been and being bootstrapped, but that doesn't last forever. And so you have to figure out a way that your content can make money. Now, we were on a really strong trajectory before this hit. We were building towards becoming, you know, a strong YouTube channel. That was where the majority of the strategy was. We had already grown our Instagram audience to well over, you know, 100,000 people. We were just building our TikTok audience at that point. And then all hell broke loose, right? And I don't feel comfortable. We had new employees just starting, you know, some from highly regarded programs, and then for this to hit and for us to say, oh, we gotta take a big step back here and now understand where we're going. And so we did, and it was a lot of throwing things against the wall to see what would stick. You know, we went into the IG live space and tried that. Everybody got exhausted with that within a couple weeks, probably, you know. We went into how can we build these remote programs, or how can we find IP that's already out there that we can invest in to come along on board. And so we threw a lot of the stuff against the wall. And some of it worked and some of it didn't. And then we kind of had to go back and look and say, okay, well, what about podcasting? You know, how does podcasting play into this? And it, because it's a, as you guys know, right, it's a lower cost entry. It's a much lower barrier to get into the content game, because then you can, you can, you can tie in video with it if you want, using things like we're using now with Riverside, and then, you know, going into Descript and using these SaaS programs to really make something quick and effective and get it out there. And you can launch something on Sounder, you know, for nothing. And you can really go in, like we've worked with a couple young podcasters who literally launched their podcast on Anchor and their AirBuds, and that's it, you know? You have to look at those things, but in the same sense, like if you want to scale, and you want to grow to become more impactful and to get more eyeballs, it takes, you have to either go viral in a couple different ways and a couple people have to pick you up from an influencer or a celebrity side, or you have to put a lot of money into strategy. And so I think those have certainly been the biggest challenges for us that we're continuing to deal with, you know, because we're not out of this. I don't feel comfortable sending Brad or Nick out to, you know, to film. And to create original content. Like, I just don't. The last thing I want to do is for someone to come back and get sick on this team. So we shut down our Boston office in immediately when this happened, because it was literally next door to one of the outbreak points that was happened to be the hotel that I stayed at every time I went into Boston. So we shut that down really quick, and everybody was working remotely. One of the best things I think everybody's heard is that we quickly realized that we can build a company remotely. It's really hard, but you can, you know, and the technology is there. It's not the same, you know, by any means, but we're able to at least continue to move forward with it.
How do you feel your background in sports has prepared you now then? Because I think, you know, when just hearing you talk about your travels when you were in Arizona and then working with the Dolphins too, there's a lot of, in the creative space, there's a lot of hurry up and wait. There's a lot of bait and switch. You think you're getting something and everything changes on a dime. So how do you feel like all of that information has prepared you for facing what you're facing today?
I couldn't have been like, listen, you can learn everything you want in school and you can learn everything you want in grad school, but you, most of the time you're not going to remember most of it. And then you're going to learn in your first 4 months on the job. I could say the same thing about athletic training that I do about getting into, you know, the sports creative world. Like, I just learned so much from sitting and watching my mentors. I remember multiple times, you know, I would just literally sit and watch the guy who hired me at the Dolphin or the D-backs, who was our senior designer, Doug Alkire, and just watch him work and watch him interact with people. And I would design, you know, I would say, okay, how can I, you know, I'm going to teach myself all these programs, right, and teach myself the Adobe suite and become as good as I can, which at that point I was actually learning Apple Motion and all this craziness, and everybody was like, nah, you got to go to After Effects. I was like, I don't want to, you know, or remembering the day when it was just like, oh shit, I should be using Photoshop layers, you know, and different things like that. So those were a long time ago, mind you, but it was kind of like learning by osmosis. So I never knew that creating mocks for pitch decks was going to come in this handy that it is now for me, you know, when I'm pitching partnerships or being around, like being constantly pissed, right? Like, let's be frank, being not happy with corporate partnerships and the requests that we would constantly get. But then realizing quickly that was your main revenue driver. And you have to play the game, right? You have to, but you have to also show, which is happening now, and it's getting to a little bit of a pinnacle. You have to be taken care of for that work. Like, you know, my images are the things that are driving the visual brand of this company. The designer's images are the things that are driving the visual brand, you know, and all of that comes into play. Everything that I learned in my time at sports, when I got out of sports, I realized, holy shit, like, I don't have to work the insane amount of hours that I did in sports. And I think a lot of that was because you're traveling, you know, and because you're working on the weekends. It's just so much different when you come into a situation like this, where you have all this institutional knowledge inside of you, and now you get a chance to put it to use. And that takes some time to understand how it transitions over into the entrepreneurial space as well. But when you start pitching, you know, partners, or you start realizing like how brands can ride along with your company organically, and so it's not just a logo slapped on something, and you've learned a lot of great lessons, you learned a lot of bad lessons. So everything, all of it came into play for me transferring out. But I was also, some of you may relate to this, but I felt locked in. I felt niched in. Like, there's no way I'm going to be able to get a job outside of sports, and I don't want to work in sports anymore. You know, like, what am I going to do? And then I quickly realized that, okay, the work ethic that I learned, good or bad, in sports transitioned to help me become who I was in a startup space. Because a startup in sports, you know what's going to happen when it's going to happen. Right. So all of you can probably relate to that. Right. Especially when you're in live production or things like that, like, you have your every second scripted, you know, when the games are happening, when they're coming up, you have your schedule. In the startup, you don't. You have milestones that you're trying to reach. And you could wake up one day and say, I'm not going to do anything today. And that just means that the startup's not going to move forward and the business isn't going to move forward. And then you could also do the opposite. Right. You can kind of take that hustle grind mentality that Diddy so elegantly tweeted about the other day and caused a riot, where you could just work 100-hour weeks doing the same thing and putting a ton of time into it. There's a time and a place for it, but I felt like, you know, in sports it was kind of constant where we were putting in that kind of time. But here there is time, you know, I got my nights and weekends back most of the time. There are occasions when I had to work, you know, but your mind constantly is thinking about those things when you're in the startup space and how to do better, and how to do more. But you don't always necessarily have to be in the office doing it. And that was, I think, one of the big differences. But yeah, it couldn't have prepared me any better for what I was doing now.
To kind of go back to the sports culture side, and for managers listening to this podcast, what advice would you give to somebody who heads at a creative department to help with your team's mental health or to create a work environment that addresses some of those issues that inherently come with sports, but can balance them on the mental health side? What, in your opinion, could help that?
The notion that done can be just done. So this, listen, it may ruffle a little feathers, but we always used to say good enough sucks. And there's a time and a place for good enough sucks. What we really mean by that is, it doesn't mean that you have to put in all the hours until it's absolutely perfect. It just means you want to make something great. And you, as creatives, we know, right, that we could redo something a million times. You know, if I'm doing an audio edit of a song that my buddy Will and I are playing, and I'm trying to master it so it's perfect, I could continue mastering it for days and weeks on end, or I can just say, okay, the average human being is going to listen to this and think, okay, that's cool. You know, we have to really kind of step back and say, what does, like, look at what the audience wants. Especially in the sports scenario, they may not know the difference between the, you know, you creating a specialized effect or hand drawing something, you know, frame by frame animation on a hype video versus buying a template to do it, right? We know. So we tend to go above and beyond in this creative space. One of the things I learned from Ariel Rivero, who worked, you know, basically was over the creative team at the Dolphins up until yesterday, actually, when we left. His whole point was like, let's be smarter. Like when it comes to masking cheerleaders, right? Thousands of cheerleader images with crazy hair, you know, maybe not great lighting, versus having your designer who's already overextended spend all his time masking all those images. Why not pay someone $1 an image on Fiverr to do it and get it done really well? And so there was this constant battle, right? This constant design battle and ego battle that I have to do it myself and I have to find the best ways to do it. And I'm going to rely on Adobe to do it for me, which we know doesn't work, you know? and what are all these things that, how can I work smarter? And so I think that's where it comes down to. Like, there were so many things. Like, we always want to put our best foot forward. I'm not saying don't put your best foot forward. I'm saying there are multiple ways to put your best foot forward. And a lot of those ways can just mean a little more investment or outside help. We got, you know, I was probably, you know, with the D-backs in one of the early teams to bring creative in-house and photography in-house. And so before, everybody was just using an agency and they were paying a crap ton of money to an agency to do it and they didn't have to worry about it. They had a design lead who was kind of leading stuff, you know? But then again, you know, there's this balance, right? I think there's a happy medium between what we can do as well as the gig economy. And now so many people are out of work. I think we just have to be really cautious about like what it means to us versus what it means to our audience. We called it the ugly baby syndrome, right? Whereas it's kind of pulling from the Seinfeld episode, "Look at my baby." Whereas when we present a creative project for a critique, and if anybody says anything bad about our baby, it's like, oh, I'm, you know, this is my baby. I can't let this go, you know, with those changes or things like that. But ultimately, we're creating for a purpose. We're not creating for ourselves when we're in the sports situation with a creative design team. So look back at the purpose, get the work done, do it at a high level, but get it out and try to have time. You know, there's one thing that Surf taught me is that you can balance those two things. You know, you can coach your kid's baseball team and still put out a great product. You just need to really kind of buckle down and focus when you're in and when you're working on something. There's a couple really good books that I always have next to me. One's called Creativity, one's called Flow, and it's understanding the optimal flow and the creative zone that you get in.
I just finished those.
Yeah, they're amazing, right? And they're deep reads.
Oh yeah.
They're super, super tough reads, but they really help, you know, understand. And I try to explain this to my wife all the time, who's a type A and doesn't understand like the creative process, or when my kids are, you know, even like it transitions to gaming, you know, like my kids are locked in a game of Valorant or something and it's like 13 rounds and they can't leave. But mom's like, it's dinner time, let's go, you know? And so it's always this conversation, you know, whereas my son's like, I lost points because I got kicked out because you turned the Wi-Fi off on me, you know, or things like that. It's like, if somebody's in the zone, let them stay in the zone. And I think that's probably one of the hard things about about moving to open office environments, right? And that it's really hard to get into a zone. You can have your headphones on. You can have a shit. Jeff Wynn used to put his coat over his head, you know, anything that says I'm working, don't bother me. Because I'm really trying to get in a creative space. Those things, like there were points when I was, you know, when I was really deep in it that I would just have to go into a suite to get my work done, you know, just because you were kind of locked, you could kind of lock yourself in at focus when you're trying to edit thousands and thousands and tag thousands and thousands of photos, you know, to get out. So those are some of the biggest things that I would say is we've got to kind of change the method of always on, always open, to, hey, and I think working from home has done that to an extent. Not everything needs to be a Zoom meeting. Not everything needs to be a call. You know, some things can be emails, just so that. And then you have to, a lot of it's on you as a creative as well. I go through times where I make sure that I just shut down my email or shut down my chat window, so that they're not there bothering me. And then I know that the world isn't going to come to an end if I don't check Twitter, you know, in the 4 hours that I was working on something. Yeah. And Garrett says it may come to an end. But
you never know. I'm very big. I love Twitter. I'm on it too much, but I do love it.
John, to peel off those two books that you just mentioned, I think now hearing you say that, it's interesting to hear you talk initially at the beginning of the conversation about better being there to provide joy and hope. And, you know, in the books, Mahaly talks about this autotelic personality where you invest yourself in what you're doing to, and you get enjoyment out of doing that. We've talked a little bit about passion and looking for, you know, especially when hiring, looking for people who have passion and really wanting to pour themselves into it. But how do you see it in particular from really investing in yourself and doing what you really enjoy with your job, but also finding a way to separate that, as you were just kind of alluding to, of knowing when to turn things off and really set yourself up to, you know, make sure you're taking care of your family, like you had mentioned earlier.
Yeah. I actually refer to it as the passion pandemic. And I really think the word to me is tough because I've interviewed so many people who have said sports is my passion, or their first line on their cover letter is sports is my passion. The Dolphins are my passion. That doesn't get any points with me.
Same.
Right. Because I have to count on you on Monday morning after we got beat by 70 points, right, for our 10th loss of the season, to come in and be able to do your job, and to come in and not be completely bummed out, whether you're one of my freelance photographers, you know, or one of the designers or the CEO. Like, you have to be able to, we always used to say, don't hire fans. That was a generalization. It was a little bit of a headline, right, that we would use on our MLC presentations or things like that. But ultimately what it says is, if you're a super fan and it affects your psyche so much if we trade one player, it's probably not a great fit for you. So I think we have this thing where it was a great quote, and I'll have to find it. I'll send it to you guys offline. But it was, you know, it talks about the things that, you know, the person who has made $1 billion in iron smelting didn't probably have a passion for iron smelting, right? They just were really good at it, and really good at sales. So they, money kind of turns it into this passion. And it said, like, the people who are going to tell you to follow your passion are the billionaires, right? Whereas I'm telling you, I don't know if you guys got a chance to watch Soul yet, but I was very openly tweeting how great it was. And it was, you know, it switches it into finding your spark, and to take from the other, you know, Netflix thing at the beginning of this, what gives you joy? And I truly believe that you're not working when you do something that gives you immense joy while you're doing it. It may not be your passion, right? I have a passion for golfing, right? Because I just, like, I love getting out there and getting on the golf course whenever I can. I'm not going to be on the PGA Tour, right? And so I'm not going to put all of my energy into making that passion come to life. You can have a passion for the Miami Dolphins. Be a fan, you know, but that doesn't necessarily mean that you should be working for the team. Because you may not know, like, you're going to see how the sausage is made at that point. And so I always say that, right? There's so many things. I almost gave it all up to go to recording engineering school, to what Brock and I were talking about earlier, because I was a musician. I loved it. It was my passion. I wanted to do it, you know, but I quickly realized that wasn't what was going to be able to pay the bills for me and our growing family. Ironically, you know, I went into sports, which in sports creative, which ultimately, you know, paid massive dividends from the network and the people that I met and the friends that I made. But I think that we have a problem with passion. I think it really has to be something that, like I always say, it's if you go in and you're looking at a clock, you're probably not doing what you should be doing. This is an old adage, right? That's been talked about for a long time. It doesn't feel like work when you're doing it. I'm working on some new stuff here with Better, and it's not felt like work, you know. That when you're doing it, the time when it does feel like work, from my experience, when I was working in a physical therapy clinic in the off season of the Phoenix Roadrunners hockey team, I hated my life. I just couldn't stand doing it. I couldn't stand going into work every day. And so I quickly realized that, okay, this is probably not what I'm meant to be doing. And you may not always be able to do what you're meant to be doing, right? Like if I had my choice, my wife asked me all the time, what would you be doing if money was no object? I said, I'd be probably out in the middle of nowhere in northern Montana in a cabin that's an art studio and just painting, you know, and sculpting my whole life, because that's really what I want to do. And that's what brings me immense joy when I do it. I get to do a little bit of that now, but if we get lucky to the point where we can, you know, focus and do that in retirement, then even better. Then you kind of leave this world on a really high note. So that's really kind of my advice, is you have to kind of break it down, right? What's your dream job versus what gives you dopamine and an ego trip? Like there's a big difference there. If you're going out and working in sports because you want to tell your friends that you work in sports, you need to take a quick step back. Or you want to tell Twitter that you work in sports to realize that it's really something. And there's a lot of people who say, this is what I meant to do, and great, do it, you know, and do it with gusto and do it with immense zeal. So that it provides you with that. But in the same sense, you know, if it causes you immense mental anguish, and you're just constantly complaining about it, then there's a problem, you know. And there's only one person who can change that for you, and that's you. That was when I was at my deepest point. My closest friend Will said, "You're the only person that can make this decision to walk away. Nobody else can do that for you." And he's right. And that's something that I tell people multiple times a month, it seems, lately.
Well, thank you so much for making Creative Sports Podcast part of your day. We'd love to hear your thoughts, feedback, and suggestions, so pop on over to the Sports Creative community on Slack and connect with us and your fellow creatives. If you're enjoying this podcast, we'd love it if you shared it with a friend or a coworker, and leave us a 5-star rating so other people will be able to find us as well. And don't forget to subscribe so that you're the first person to catch each new episode. Remember, the world needs your voice, so keep creating.